tomorrow all the things were gone. I'd worked for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, where the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. God bless the USA.
Well, I want to thank Lee Greenwood and the Air Force's singing sergeants for our opening song. I have to tell you, that powerful way to open up Connecting the Dots, and I thank everyone for tuning in. We've got a great program today. We're going to open up with Michael Badnarik, and Michael ran for president several times for the Libertarian Party. He is a constitutional scholar, and I agreed to have Michael on early to go ahead and do the advertisement. He's doing a constitutional training program, and he wants to let people know about that so they can tune in and be part of that. And I just kind of felt like it would be a perfect lead-in for what we're going to be doing today, and that is a discussion about how the alt left, the socialists and the Marxists and the traitors within our government are now in the process of taking away private property rights and bringing in the public, so-called public trust, which is there to replace private property. Michael, I see you're on. Welcome to the program. Please tell our listeners about what you're working on, and tell our listeners how they can be part of your constitutional training program.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I have studied the Constitution for about 30 years, and I understand why the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution, basically to defend our life, liberty, and property. In fact, during the class, I teach my students that, you know, there's a one-word answer for every question about the Constitution, and that word is property. You know, that's what it's all about. Once you discover who the owner of the property is, then you've established all the rights questions. But I've been teaching this class for 20 years. There seems to be a resurgence of interest in the Constitution, for good reason, I suppose. I'm offering it online. That makes it easier for people to attend. You don't have to travel anywhere. You don't have to get a hotel room. It's going to be Monday through Friday for 2 hours each night from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time. And people can find out by visiting my website, which is badnarik.org, B-A-D-N-A-R-I-K, badnarik.org. And it's the first link under services. And you can, it's going to be a Zoom presentation. And hopefully we're going to eliminate a lot of the misconceptions that people have about the Constitution. Most of what people think they know about the Constitution is wrong. But once you get, your compass focused a little bit and understand the purpose of the Constitution, the Constitution doesn't give us rights. It puts limitations on the federal government. And so hopefully by educating people about the way things are supposed to work, perhaps we can improve our political and social situation across the country.
Well, you know, it's taken a while, but I think you and I would agree that for the first time in our lifetimes, we're seeing a lot of interest in the Constitution and in our rights under the Constitution. And people are finally starting to get involved. And that's why it's so important to get the training that you offer, because then they're armed with facts. They're not armed with some of the disinformation that they learn in school. Because the fact is, very few of our schools educate our children in our Constitution, in our form of government, beyond the most rudimentary little concepts. And even then, they don't promote individualism and private property rights. They promote collectivist crap and try to tell our children that that was what the founders intended. Talk a little about that, Michael.
Well, I discuss why we have any government at all. And I said, everybody's upset with the government. Why don't we just get rid of government and have anarchy? The people, no, we don't want that. I said, well, how about socialism or communism? Most of the countries in the world are either socialist or communist. All those countries can't be wrong, can they? And everybody seems to know they don't want communism, but they fail to realize that it's already here. I actually talk about the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto, and I demonstrate that all 10 of those principles are operating in the United States at this very moment. And, you know, they say if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, doesn't matter what you call it, the fact of the matter is it's a duck. And when you suddenly come to realize that we are living in a communist organized government, then people get really angry. If you think they're angry now, they're just feeling oppressed. But when they realize that the government is not doing anything in their best interest, and in fact most of what our government does is unconstitutional. Now I'm sure that strikes people as being outrageous, that couldn't possibly be true. But I do something really unorthodox during my class. I actually have students read the Constitution. And they go, well, that's not the way we do it here. I go, really? So what are you telling me? The Constitution says this. You're telling me we don't do that. Then by your own definition, you've just identified something else that is unconstitutional. And I've actually had grown men crying at the end of my 8-hour class when they realized just how corrupt the United States government really is. Mm-hmm. And so my class does not solve the problem. I have people call me all the time, go, Michael, what you ought to do. And then they give me some long list. It's like, I'm not going to be able to do it. What we need is, you know, 320 million Americans who understand these basic principles. The founding fathers dedicated their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to these principles. If you don't understand what the principles are, how are you going to be willing to defend them? Mm-hmm. It's sad how little people know. It was an Independence Day celebration. My friends and I did a dramatic reading of the Declaration of Independence, kind of like a Shakespeare play. You know, we read the entire Declaration, and a young college girl came up and said, can I get the transcript of that? And I was confused. I handed her my copy. And after she had gone, I realized she asked for the transcript. She didn't recognize the Declaration of Independence when she heard it. I don't know if she thought my friends and I had written that. We are in desperate, desperate trouble, and I'm not going to live long enough to fix it. I've dedicated the last 30 years of my life to trying to fix this. The best that I can do is teach younger people the principles, and hopefully they will step up and restore our cherished republic.
Well, you know, that's kind of key to the whole thing, Michael. You and I have been in this battle a long time. And what we've seen, and this is a sad statement, but Americans have had it too easy for too long. And they allowed for the hijacking of our government by people who really didn't have our best interests at heart, but yet they were too lazy to get off the couch and be part of the solution. They're too used to their Monday night football, their game shows, and all the nonsense that makes up so much of American daily life anymore. It's time for the young people to realize what they're inheriting is an absolute mess. And if they don't become part of the solution, we are not going to have a republic. In fact, you're right. We haven't had a legitimate constitutional republic for quite some time, but we have not realized how far down the wrong path we've gone. That's why programs like yours are so important.
I had a close friend of mine ask me to come and teach his two 16-year-old girls about the Constitution. I went, oh, absolutely. Just tell me, when and where. And then I realized these girls are smart, but they are only 16 years old. They don't have a lot of life experience. You know, talking to them about the Constitution, it'll be like history. You know, the founding fathers, rah, rah, okay, so what? In order to understand why the Constitution is so important, I created another presentation just for these teenage girls. It's posted on my website, badnarek.org. It's under videos, and it's called How to Form a Civil Society. It's free. Anybody can go out there and watch How to Form a Civil Society. And when you watch that, you go, oh my gosh, we have to come up with a plan, something to protect our private property. Well, guess what? The founding fathers have already come up with a plan. All we have to do is enforce it.
Well, that's pretty amazing. And I have to say, you're, as far as I'm concerned, you're probably one, if not the one of maybe two or three of the most prominent constitutional scholars we've got in this country. And I have to say that people would be well advised to tune in and follow your constitutional training, because you'll get a good education from a gentleman who knows what he's talking about and has spent his whole life dedicated to this process. Michael, tell the listeners again how you plan to structure your training program, and then how they can get on and go ahead and register for that.
In order to eliminate any travel or hotel expenses, it's going to be a Zoom presentation, much like this one. It will be 2 hours a night for 5 nights, Monday through Friday. It begins April 19th, a week from today. April 19th, your listeners probably know, is Patriots Day. It's the 246th anniversary of the battle at Lexington and Concord. Mm-hmm. I think that was an appropriate day to start the class. But it'll be from 7 to 9 Central, 2 hours a night, and people will be able to ask questions. I will stay online and answer questions. It will definitely create more questions than it answers. My course is called An Introduction to the Constitution, and hopefully it will stimulate you into doing your own research. I mean, there's only so much I can teach in 10 hours, but they can visit my website, badnarek.org, and in order to sign up for the class, they would just go to the services menu, and the Zoom presentation for the Constitution is the first item under that services menu.
Great. Okay. Well, I look forward to seeing it. I'll actually try to tune in myself and follow that, because we all need to be supporting one another on this basis. It's important that people understand. You've been one of our Red Pill speakers in Hartford, Connecticut here a few years back. So you're familiar with the Red Pill concept, and you talk about private property. property. Michael, you're welcome to stay on as long as you want. We're going to go ahead and move into the end of rural America. We're going to be talking about how nonprofits, NGOs, and foundations have been working in collusion with government to bring about a transfer of wealth in this country and a transfer of property rights from individuals to a collectivist system. And we're going to be talking about how important property rights are. Michael, thank you for what you're doing. Like I say, you're welcome to stay on. We would love to have your feedback on some of this stuff during this discussion.
I'll stick with you.
Okay, wonderful. Well, we're going to be meeting some folks that we've not had on air before. One of them is a young man that I've known for a number of years. He's one of the sharpest young individuals that I know. He's been involved in Central Montana in trying to fight some of the takeovers of public and private lands in eastern and central Montana. It's called the American Prairie Reserve, but he's also been involved in a lot of land issues, and he is extremely talented as a writer, and we're working on the speaker part of it right now. This is going to be part of Nathan's training for that. We also have Dick Ewing, who is a gentleman from Washington State who's gotten involved with the property rights movement. He was he's a chemical engineer by training, but he became the president of the Washington Farm Bureau, even though he's not really a farmer, just because of his work on property rights issues. And we're going to have an open discussion this afternoon on what has been happening to the United States in the past. It's really been happening in the past 100 years, but especially in the last 30 years. And really, it's kind of an offshoot of a program called UN Agenda 21, which has been kind of a catalyst for all that. But anyway, let's get the discussion started. Nathan, welcome to the program. Good to see you, my young friend. And tell our folks what you've been involved in and how you got involved in this whole battle for property rights.
Yep. Thanks much, Dan, for having me on the program. This process started about 10 years ago for me, probably. My background was originally I grew up on a farm and ranch initially, but moved to southwestern Montana, Bozeman, and there I studied theology, history, and a lot of different works. That's when I started really reading. I didn't really read much before then. Somebody gave me some really good books. C.S. Lewis was one of them, and then Thomas Merton. So it started studying kind of just theology, involved a little bit in the Bible college down there, but then shifted more into just history, American history, and really developing a passion for the men and women and families that built America, and not just that built America, but the common law heritage that goes way farther back than the founding of this nation. So that's been a long journey. About 7 years ago, my stepfather was diagnosed with a brain tumor and passed away 6-7 months after that from a brain tumor. So that, in God's providence, put me back on the ranch out here, eastern Montana. So that brought me into a different context, and I started redirecting my research and studies to understand more, because we were facing at that time going through adjudication of water rights with irrigation rights on our place, different things like that. So I started really looking into that a little bit, and that started a journey of studying more and started to find out how much money, tax money and different things, were being allocated through federal programs for land acquisition. And I actually met Dick Ewing around that time in my life at a conference. And so that helped shape some of my thinking and a starter point for me to study more into how those dollars are being appropriated through federal programs to acquire private inholdings and lands and absorb them into public domain for whatever purpose. So with that, that led to, I found the American Prairie Reserve came on to my radar, which was not a federal initiative per se. It's a private nonprofit organization, but that fits, I think, as a variant of federal land acquisition. These NGOs that come in because they're tax exempt, they bypass the public treasury, have wealthy foundations that back them, and influence a lot of policy and federal initiatives as well that help their philosophies and their agendas. So I worked on that for the last 3 years, 4 years, with county governments, landowners, and different things. And now had opportunity to do some work in Washington on some grizzly bear reintroduction stuff with Environmental Species Act and in those areas. So that's kind of a brief, I guess, last 8 years, 10 years of my life. And that's now we're here today.
Well, I have to tell you, I think most people understand now, finally, in Montana, that we really are under an assault to take away private property. They aren't kidding. This is part of UN Agenda 21, but it's been publicly stated a number of times, but people don't believe it. They're going to have to start learning to believe it, because private property is the number one target of Marxism. It's you have to eliminate the right to own property to be able to institute Marxist and communist and true socialist policies, because the fact is private property includes your mind, your body. The ownership of land is only one part of that, and they're attacking all those rights so that they can take away everything that you have and make you be part of a culture that just goes along to get along and just, you know, whatever they give you, you're supposed to be grateful for. And other than that, just sit down and shut up. And we aren't those kind of people. And I know, Nathan, you certainly aren't. Dick, I spoke with you briefly on the phone the other night, but I don't know you, but I got a feeling we're going to become fast friends. I've read a lot of information about you, and I know you've been very active in Washington State on a lot of the issues that Nathan's been involved with. Welcome to the program, and tell our viewers and listeners a little bit more about yourself.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being invited to be with you, Dan. I hope you're hearing me okay with my system.
Great. Yep. No, you're doing good. Great.
So my background, as you mentioned, was a BA in chemistry, and I became interested in my Christian faith and theology at the same time during my junior year in college. And that led me to get involved in studying that topic a little more thoroughly by going to seminary. But one of my most important experiences was being an intern minister at a church in Palo Alto, California, where I was introduced to Francis Schaeffer's works. Mm-hmm. And the challenge he had in those works was developing a Christian worldview. And that got me to thinking about how God has intended things to operate. And one of them does include the priority of the individual and the ownership of property as key. In fact, it is these ideas that were developed during the Middle Ages in our development of Western culture. And that is one of the reasons that the Northern European countries, as well as North America, became so profitable, was the development of property rights and the ability to own and operate a business, or to farm and own your property and the yield of your hands. In fact, that was actually key to overcoming the plagues that were going on between the 11th and 14th century. But my journey led me back into the workplace, where I was a analytical chemist for a while, but during this time, my wife and I decided that we wanted to have more of a full expression of some of the things that we began to understand through our faith. And one of them was to have private property and live in a more rural context. And that led us to the Menhel Valley in Washington State. One of the things that developed there while we were getting settled in was the interest in Aspen Corporation developing a ski hill on one of the mountains in the valley. And of course, this created a lot of environmental reaction to that whole idea. In fact, we had people coming into the valley just to live here to prevent it from being aspenated, as they said, from Aspen Corporation, who was going to be the lead on the ski hill. It was there I also got involved in the environmental movement, where we were looking at how our forests were being managed. And one of the things that I observed in that was the main goal of the environmentalist was not how to use the forest in a better way, but to turn it back over to nature and prevent any intrusion of human activity on the forest. One of the key things that woke me up and changed my view that was more sympathetic at that time towards environmentalism was the fact that I, in my associations as a sales representative, came in contact with a company called Scientific Certification Systems that developed a way to green harvest wood products from the Amazon. And they are very interested in coming up to Okanagan County, where I live, and present how they would do this. And I saw that as a solution to some of the environmentalist concerns. But that went over like a lead balloon. And that's when I understood that environmentalism ultimately was not concerned about the interrelationship between man and the environment and a healthy forest. They're more concerned about preserving nature and preventing man from actually intruding on nature, which is a key assumption of environmentalism. And my activity in that area also led me to be involved in what is called the Watershed Council, where that was developed under RCW in the state called 9082 to manage water resources in the state in deference to the new listing of salmon species in the rivers of Washington State. So I saw that as a very key challenge in a social engineering program, which it has turned out to be, and it's affected land use, access to property, and also access to water. So those were the things that led me into the Washington State Farm Bureau and being president of our local chapter in Okanagan County. So that gives you a little bit of background, I hope, on kind of where I headed, a little bit of history of how I got into some of these things.
Well, I'm sure that you know, you've probably met Patrick Moore. If not, Patrick Moore was the one of the founders of... I just dropped the name.
Greenpeace,
absolutely, of Greenpeace. And he, like you, saw what was happening, how the environmental movement was being hijacked, and it's being hijacked by radical anti-humanists, and they see humanity as a plague on the environment. They see humanity as needing to be radically reduced. You know, the people who promote Agenda 21 and different programs like that talk about reducing the human population by 93% to fewer than a billion people. They don't talk about highest and best use and ways to protect the environment. They just talk about ways to get rid of people and how to turn everything back to nature as if nature was always the best and highest and best use of the land. And in fact, it's not. But anyway, I want to get back to Nathan talking a little bit about his experiences in dealing with government agencies. I know both of you know and have worked with Jim Carlson. And some of the ways that there are organizations now challenging the way the federal government and NGOs, nonprofits, and foundations are now so much in bed with each other. I'd love to have both of you talk about that. Nathan, let's start with you.
Yeah. I think it... You and Dick pretty well, just in summary fashion, showed how, which many people already know, a lot of the environmental movement is not based on concepts that balance the needs of the human environment in relationship to the natural environment. So with that understanding of the push philosophically in those directions, which also pushes for collective ownership, public ownership of land and bringing and holdings back into public domain, different things like that. But the history of our public land laws, though some of the legislation post 1950 has some problems in it, I think, that I wouldn't agree with that need to be somehow dealt with. Nonetheless, even in spite of some bad legislation, most public land statutes have embedded within them the basic fundamental foundational principles of our Republican form of government, which is based on the separation of powers, not just legislatively, judicially, and executive, but a further breakdown in state governments and then political subdivisions and county governments. So there's geopolitical boundaries that have jurisdictional authorities at those different levels, and in relationship to the Western United States and states like Washington or Montana or other states in the West, where there's some more than others, there's a substantial amount of federal lands. We're in this situation where the government, the federal government, in retaining substantial amounts of those lands in the West, has led into some conflicts and issues with land use, tax base, resource use, access to resources, and all those different things at a local level. And I believe a lot of the legislation for coordination in the Federal Land Policy Management Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, some of these acts back that set some of the procedures for environmental analysis and things like that have requirements for those coordination processes with local governments, local natural resource policies for the areas concerned. But there really hasn't been an effective approach, I think, from local government, from political subdivisions at a state level, to be engaging in that process and holding our government counterparts accountable in those processes. So as a result, much of the lands within county jurisdictions in Montana and places like Washington State and elsewhere have shifted more into a passive preservation classification of lands that limits productive use of the land, access, and other things like that I've discussed. So with all that said, one of the things that we really focus on in relationship to those issues is equipping county government, local elected officials with what they need in the statutes and the laws defining their local customs, their local cultures, their socioeconomic environment, and those different elements, and rooting that within federal statutory authority and holding those agencies accountable in the process to take into consideration those different things, which includes private property rights, private inholdings, rights of ways, water rights, all those different things within county jurisdictions should be inventoried, analyzed, and considered and compensated if they're taken through federal decision-making and processes. So that's kind of where the rubber meets the road in some respect. And I just want to thank Michael for his work on the Constitution, because that's what we need to do in these processes the foundations, like I said, in a lot of federal statutes, even those principles embedded in the Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence are weaved throughout law. The enabling acts of Montana, North Dakota, Washington, and I think Idaho, and I think it was, trying to think of the date on it, 1889, I think, is when the legislature, the Congress, passed the enabling acts and the legislation for those four states to draft constitutions.
Right. It was 1889. Yeah.
Yep. So 1889. And the requirement in that legislation for the enabling acts for those states to draft constitutions was that the government was required to be Republican in form and in consistency with the principles of the Declaration of Independence. So one thing I want to say off the, on the, in the outset here, before we go more down the path of some of these discussions, is the Declaration of Independence states that we find these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, with certain unalienable rights given by their creator, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. And then governments are instituted among men to preserve those rights. That's the function of government under a constitutional republic. So that is the philosophical assertion and foundation for Republican good government under the U.S. Constitution, is in the Declaration of Independence. The antithesis to that is the 1933 Humanist Manifesto, which says the universe is self-existing, which matches up with Hegel's philosophy of that the state is God walking on earth. So what we have here is two conflicting worldviews, one that's based on a centralized top-down control of statist authority based on Darwinistic philosophy and Marxism, and a Judeo-Christian basis that recognizes God as the supreme lawgiver, men is secondary to that, and all men at every level of authority are accountable to that law. And so that's the foundation. I just wanted to state that as a presuppositional basis. And that's what we can stand on as Americans and as patriots that most people through history didn't have in the same context that we have today. So, I'll leave it at that, and you can.
Well, Nathan, you just proved why I'm so proud of you, my young friend, because you have a degree of understanding that I would say probably fewer than 1 in 1,000 have the level of understanding of what our government is all about and what our relationship is with our creator. So I have to tell you, I'm very proud of you, young man. I think you do a terrific job. Dick, you please weigh in on this discussion, because it's obvious that we are going down the wrong road. And I want to hear your opinion of how we got down that wrong road in the first place.
Well, I think one of the key things has to do with the trend in Western thought. So originally, truth was understood as an absolute. If it was wrong to have sex outside of marriage, it was wrong to do so. And the opposite was not an illustration of love. The thing that has happened with the understanding as we moved from, say, the Renaissance period into the Age of Enlightenment was the focus on reason as the main source for deriving all truth. So that left God out of the picture. And once you leave God out of the picture and make man the reference point philosophically, you separate yourself from even able to define what morality is and what right and wrong is. So that's illustrated in what happened with Hegel when he offered his idea of what you would call relative truth today, where what you have is you have proposition A is opposite to proposition B, when in conflict results in a new concept C. So that was a change in truth from absolutes to an evolutionary view of truth. So that was the whole experiment of modernity, was to work out this rationalistic form of evolutionary truth, and it has failed pretty bad. Mm-hmm. Out of that came the reaction to that, which is called postmodernism, which has rejected any form of meta-narrative for evaluating what life is about. Therefore, a complete rejection of any truth, and a movement to the emotional. So without a framework of truth to work from, and it being postmodernism in style and moving to a woke philosophy, we have no means for dialogue or resolving anything on the level of government, because there is no truth to pursue. So that's where we are culturally in our society right now. From there, you also have the parallel erosion of our own government, because you probably well know that government is based upon a separation of powers. And so the separation of powers, of course, are the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, and that triad is carried through to the state level as well as down to the county level. And what has happened, because our government is not taking the responsibility in each of its areas of responsibility, like the legislative, we have the country being primarily run by the executive operations of the government. Mm-hmm. It trickles down into our agencies that we have to deal with every day. And they're the ones that are creatively going against property rights, putting the environment ahead of individuals, and putting a crisis ahead of property rights and the things that make life work. So it's the executive procedures that we are having to battle, and we need to wake up to how that is really affecting us and give our government a real sense of accountability to go back to its threefold separation of powers rather than concentrating powers in an executive branch. So that's what's really killing us.
Mm-hmm. And that's how the environmental organizations have been able to take so much control of our government, because they've done it through the executive branch. They've done it through administrative agencies. And we've got a process right now where they basically they take turns playing musical chairs. A lot of the people who are part of the environmental NGOs end up in appointments to various government agencies. And after they've done their damage there, then they go back to various NGOs and foundations again. It's kind of a cross-pollination in a very nasty, very negative way if you're concerned about property rights.
Yeah, that's really quite right. I'll give you a good example, because when we had a listing of salmon as endangered in the Washington State rivers, we had National Marine Fisheries officials coming in and initiating the enforcement on a state level when they're actually a federal government level. And that is an intrusion on states' rights, actually, in controlling their own waters. Mm-hmm. One of the things that they force our state to do is make a reciprocity agreement with the federal government that whatever would be determined by the federal government, particularly the Fish and Wildlife Service, would also be copied by the state Fish and Wildlife Service, and they would mutually enforce one another. So that was our own state giving up its rights to be a stand-in between its citizens and the federal government.
Yeah, and Dick, I don't think it's any accident that Washington State has the highest concentration of communists, who are card-carrying communists, in the United States. There's over 50,000 of them and in Washington State. And that goes through to your Governor Inslee and all the crazy nonsense that comes out of the Seattle Vancouver area. And Thumper, my producer Thumper, had a question for you, Dick.
Okay.
Yeah. Hi, Dick. By the way, I'm in Spokane.
Oh,
and geez. So, and I have a lot of family over there in the Medhow Valley. So, we're practically neighbors. you know, I've been involved in a lot of different things here in Spokane County. And a lot of it is through my enjoyment of my Second Amendment, privileges or not, not privileges, rights. And, one of the things that, I don't know if you saw what I put there in the Zoom chat to you there, but, our public lands commissioner here in Washington State is, I'm not a proponent for her at all, Hillary France. I've seen what the state is doing with our public lands. Lands that are supposed to be open to people to be able to recreate on. And, right about the 4th of July, the fire danger, all of a sudden, no matter what the conditions are, all of a sudden, shoot way up. And we get these wonderful, probably $5,000 a piece gates get locked. And the people get locked off the public lands. Now, I'm very familiar with what happens with our public lands here in Washington State. They're used as a part of a trust to supposedly support the our schools through the sale of timber or the leasing of these lands to, that are farmlands and ranch lands and things like that. Horribly mismanaged. Just is all of that. And I'm sure that you have seen more than enough of that in the Medhow Valley. Your comments on that?
Well, that's quite the case. When we first moved to the Medhow Valley, and my familiarity with the impact on the forest products industry in the Okanagan County, at that time, just before we arrived, we were taking out about 120 million board feet of harvestable timber out of the Okanagan National Forest. A single person began filing lawsuits against the Forest Service for not following its forest management plan. And through all these groups piling on top of the National Forest Service, telling it not to harvest, keep things natural. We have barely 6, maybe 10 million board feet taken out every year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's Michael Garrity. Wasn't that Michael Garrity? Because he ended up moving to Montana. He's doing the same thing in Montana now.
Well, the person I'm thinking of is Lee Bernheisel.
Oh. And,
also, the fellow that's ahead of Ecosystem Northwest, that's Mick Friedman. So those are the two people that have actually gone after the National Forest in Washington State.
I see.
And then on top of that, we have 360 environmental groups at operation in Washington State that are coordinated through the Northwest Ecosystem Alliance. So if something comes up in one area, it's echoed by all the others through communication. So yeah, this big echo chamber and very few people understanding what is going on and objecting to that approach.
Well, they've done a similar thing in Montana. There's 500 groups in Montana doing a very similar thing, and they have a very incestuous relationship, at least understanding that when one does something, they get a lot of support from the other groups. And again, it's always in the wrong direction. It's always in a direction of non-use rather than reasonable use and getting productive use out of things. Nathan, I met you, I think, when I was still a county commissioner, but one of the big disappointments of my life, going back to the coordination process, is we had 100% approval at our MACO conference of a draft of a piece that we were trying to do to bring coordination to the state of Montana. And we had 100% approval at our state convention. And then when we took it to the legislature, MACO and some of the counties in MACO were our biggest opponents to this. And what it really boils down to is, and I have to say this, MACO and NACO are the two most socialist organizations in the country, because what they do is they farm the government and NGOs and different foundations for money for all these different projects that they want to do in the county. And so they don't have the guts to stand up against any of these groups, and they end up fighting the people who are trying to protect private property. Nathan, you know that yourself. You've been there, you've been battling, and now you've got some county commissioners working with you. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, and I just refer back to Dick's comment, two things. One, he mentioned 360 organizations in Washington. I don't know how many NGOs are at work in Montana. Dan mentioned 500. There's a lot of them.
500. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but I just want to make the point that that creates what that does. This, all these different sub NGO organizations, creates the illusion of a grassroots movement. But if you really look at it, you look at the connections and how the money flows, and like Dick kind of explained with the echo chamber, the way the information flows, it's a top-down centralized philosophy that's being funneled down into these sub-organizations. And now they're even helping local rancher or farmer groups start nonprofit organizations to do different things, which some of the things that are being done at that level may not be wholly objectionable, but it does create a compromise at the local level, especially when local governments start joining on that. And I think that's some of the problem with modern conservatism, is that, like Hayek said, is they're the champions of the middle road. We tend to think oftentimes that, especially when these things, because they are at our door, they seem unbeatable. There's so much funding and so many organizations, academia, and all this stuff behind these pushes, you know, so it can be intimidating. But compromise is never the way to go in relationship to fundamental principles. Many of the original colonies and their constitutions had that clause in their constitution, that the constant reoccurrence to fundamental principles is essential to preserving liberty. So that's, so back to, you know, local government and coordination, trying to be involved in the process. The difficulty there is there's often disconnects between counties throughout a state, whether it's Washington, Montana, Colorado, Utah, whatever. We're especially rural, like where we are, rural Montana, and a lot of county commissioners aren't technologically savvy. You have to go directly, basically sit down with them, and traveling through the states, not short distances. But nonetheless, with the increasing landscape scale initiatives in the region, APR in particular, and all these NGOs that are pushing these different initiatives, more and more counties and just people in voting constituency within counties are starting to recognize, you know, the issues and the potential threats that are coming with these types of initiatives. Because what they do, if you read the documentation on these federal initiatives and these NGOs, they basically, and this is how the conservation easement program in the state of Montana, the Montana Sage-Grouse Conservation Program, and the fund that funds perpetual conservation easements, basically just the idea you have a development right is considered a threat. Just the fact you could go build that road or grant an access right away across your property or plow that field, it's not directly stated in most cases as such, but indirectly, those are being labeled as being what the actual threat is. So when you compromise and jump on those initiatives that define you as the property owner as the threat, you might think you can come out on the good end on that process, but I don't think that's going to be the case. So the challenge we have is to take back the narrative. We can't adopt the language of the Gaia Earth philosophy of these environmental foundations that is the antithesis to the founding principles of our constitutional republic, private property, county governments, and all those things. So the task is, I guess, is there's a part of it's a re-education process, or not re-education, but a reconnecting with our history and our heritage. But with the nuts and bolts of it is, you know, when it comes to engaging in the process, federal agencies, when they do different things that affect land use on federal lands within those jurisdictions, have to go through a statutory process and a procedural process. So we've been starting in the last couple of years to engage in those processes. We've had two or three resource management plans, which are federal documents that go through an environmental impact statement that end up governing the resource use and management of all the federal lands in like the Lewistown field office region, for instance. That covers like, I think, a 14 county region, pretty large chunk of Montana. So we've engaged on those processes with relative success, with bringing county governments up to speed, submitting substantive comment into those processes, identifying local customs and cultures, private property rights, grazing rights. And in our case in Montana, we mapped out the Taylor Grazing Act districts in eastern Montana, and federal documents for decades have vacated from their management plans the inclusion of TGA grazing districts. So one of the reasons these environmental groups think they can come into these like eastern Montana and repurpose all this rural land to passive preservation and wildlife specific purposes, in part, I think, is because our federal agencies have not incorporated the history of public land law, the TGA grazing districts, and the statutory purpose for which those were established: protection of the range, protection of dependent commensurate properties, there's your property rights, and stabilization of the livestock industry. Mm-hmm. Those are the three statutory foundations for the Taylor Grazing Act. And since I don't have the exact time frame, those weren't included in the federal process, but for at least 20 years, probably plus, those geopolitical maps have not been incorporated or included within some of those planning documents. So we pointed that out. And because we believe that creates statutory conflicts, and also is the reason these environmental groups have come to think that they can just easily come into a region like this and repurpose not just 5,000 acres, but literally 3.5 million acres to passive preservation and biodiversity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, the federal government and these NGOs have kind of slow walked the idea through government that they no longer, as part of the impacts that they're supposed to be studying when they do any of these new programs, are supposed to be economic as well as environmental. And they're dropping the economic part of it. And that, I think, is where you and Jim Carlson and Dick and others are trying to force them to go back to the study of the actual economic impacts that these are having on private lands. Isn't that a big part of this?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, Dick, I want to get your opinion on this, and then I'm curious. After you're done, I'd like to go to Michael, and he's been paying attention to this discussion. I'd like to hear his opinion.
Well, I think one of the things that I'm noticing with these environmental groups is many of them are not engaged in what I would call real life style work. Mm-hmm. Yet they claim themselves to be an authority to come in and tell you how to use your land and use your water and what crops to grow, what not crop to grow, and then whether or not your cows belch or not. And one of the things that happens with this, when you have an outside people doing that, they're actually infringing on the concept of liberty. The primary concept of liberty in our Constitution is freedom from coercion. And that is basically what they're doing. They're coming in and tell you how you live your life. The problem that I see when you have an outside group weighing in on what another county or a group of people should be doing, they do not have the understanding of how the economics and life work in that particular situation. And so a very big example is our agriculture in Okanagan County is actually tied in with the ability of a member of the family actually being able to work outside of the farming to bring extra income into farming, unless that farm is particularly large. And there are very few large farms. Well, that main resource for actually having a job that paid well was the forest product industry. Some of the farmers would go and work in the forest product industry, come home, take care of their farm, and work in harvest, and they made money that way and survived. But once the forest product industry went away, that also had an attrition on agriculture. And so there is not a holistic understanding of how economies work on the environmental movement. And it is actually destroying and dismantling our economy by what they choose to do and enforce upon a county. So if once you remove an equity like a forest product industry and you want to go back and now treat the forest for forest fires and reduce the fire load, you don't have the workforce to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happened in Okanagan County.
Well, I think, Dick, you recognize that your comments are well placed, because one of the major efforts of communizing the United States of America is getting rid of the middle class. And, you know, you understand the economics of this, and that's the part that most people don't get, is that all these attacks on various industries and programs that that individuals promote are being attacked, because if you can get rid of the middle class, you can get rid of a lot of the people. You're right. A lot of the people that live on the land are only here because they have outside jobs. They can't afford to make a living off the land because they've stripped that ability with all the different major businesses like Cargill and Monsanto and all these huge agricultural entities. And so your point is extremely right. When you get rid of all the other ways that you can make money in a rural environment, you're going to get rid of the rural environment.
Yeah, so we have tourism in its place, which is not really a wealth creator.
No, not at all. Michael, you've been patiently listening to our discussion so far. What do you think? I'd like to hear your opinion about this from a constitutional sense.
Well, I love to hear all these people defending private property because, as I said in my opening piece, I whittled the Constitution down to one word, and that is property. Mm-hmm. But I also teach my students that we are engaged in an ideological war. It is a war of words, and it's a war of ideas. And the sad thing is that people don't notice that there is this war going on. You know, a conventional war with guns and bullets and hand grenades, that's loud and it's scary, and people know that there's this, that they're in a battle. But when the communists and socialists come up with, well, the greatest good for the greatest number, go, wow, that sounds pretty good. We're just going to have this utopia because we're going to have the greatest good for the greatest number. Well, people don't understand that's directly taken from the Communist Manifesto. It's impossible because we all have individual rights. If I eat a dozen donuts, I'm the one that's going to get fat. You know, if I study until 2 o'clock in the morning, it's my IQ that's going to go up, nobody else's. And this whole communist idea is that we're all just going to be happy together, one size fits all. And one of the things that I hope my class does is to explain to people these ideas and explain how the communist ideas are flawed and give you the knowledge and the tools to dissect those, you know, irrational ideas. And unfortunately, an ideological war, if not, you know, stopped, will eventually become a conventional war.
It will become a hot war.
Yeah. It's going to become a hot war. And we're getting closer and closer to that all the time. The government's taking over our property, forcing us into smaller and smaller spaces. And sooner or later, people are going to realize that their only option is to shoot back. And so for people that want to avoid that type of violence, my class is a tool that you can use to defeat the ideological war so we don't have to fight a conventional war.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's well put, because you're absolutely right. And Nathan, we'll go back to the private property issue in eastern Montana. I think everyone here understands, and we should pass this along to our listeners, there was no such thing as a non-governmental organization prior to the formation of the United Nations. It is a construct of their plan to basically communize the world. And in doing that, they formed something called a non-governmental organization. They were sanctioned by the UN. They have a number of them that have been not only sanctioned, but they're certified by the UN. And they supposedly represent private interests, but grassroots private interests. They're supposed to be representing the little guy, when in fact a lot of these things have become multi-billion dollar industries. Nathan, talk a little about that maybe.
Yeah, I think one crucial thing with the tax exempt status non-governmental organization is the philosophy behind giving exemption to an organization is that they provide a service that otherwise would have needed expenditures from the public treasury. Let me say that again. The whole philosophy behind giving exemption to any organization is that they provide a service for the community that otherwise would have needed expenditure from the public treasury. In this case, not only are they not providing services by tying up and consolidating land and pulling it out of productive agriculture, it's coming at a heavy price tag to the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. Because they're the ones who end up footing the bill and the cost for bad decision-making. See, these socialists, the only reason socialism functions at microcosms within our system that some people argue, well, look at our municipalities, they're socialistic, they do fine. But that's only because of the capitalist environment that surrounds them that pays for their losses. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with these NGOs. When they push these initiatives and these ideas that we can create wealth out of nothing, bypass the public treasure and tie up productive land, my question is, what service is that providing to the community? And what business does the government have, our federal government have, giving exemption to those organizations to tie up development rights? The whole history of public lands in the West, in 1964, the Congress passed a temporary act that many people don't even know about. It's not the Multiple Use and Sustained Yield Act, but I think it was actually called the Multiple Use and Sustained Yield Act, but not the one most people are familiar with. It was temporary legislation, and it created a commission, a legislatively established commission, to put together a full comprehensive report of the public land laws throughout history as an advisory report to the Congress to draft legislation. And that's ultimately, that report was published in 1970. 6 years later is when they promulgated the Federal Land Policy Management Act, the National Forest Management Act, Public Rangeland Improvement Act, a whole series of public lands law, which Federal Land Policy Management Act is the cornerstone of, was a result of that report. So in that report, in at the outset, this is the second paragraph of that report. Contrary to the traditions of sovereigns elsewhere in the world, the United States disposed of much of the land at nominal prices and encouraged private ownership. At the same time, in order to promote the common school system and later institutions of higher learning, Congress granted substantial acreages to new states as they were formed. So the key there is even so this congressional committee that served as an advisory and comprehensive report to the Congress to draft public land laws acknowledged a very key point right here that separates the American system of government from every other sovereign monarch or otherwise through history, is that all the lands that were held in trust by the federal government out to the Mississippi were disposed of by creating distinct Republican states with equal rights and privileges and immunities as the other original states, and disposed of those properties to private appropriation and transfer of title. And that is the reason America paid off its debt. That's the reason America became from nothing to a world superpower and leading the way, is those very concepts of private appropriation and private control of resource use and the separation of that and the division of labor and how that all unfolded. But I just wanted to make the point that, yet again, these principles are embedded through law, through congressional committees, and all these different things. For instance, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, 2 years, take note, before our Constitution, federal Constitution, 1776, you have the Declaration of Independence. And then from there, you have the Articles of Confederation, which govern the colonies through the war and through all those years up until the federal Constitution in 1789. So the Northwest Ordinance was 1787, which divided the Northwest Territory into smaller territories. So as soon as one of those territories had 60,000 people, it could apply to Congress to become a state. So there was a disposal there from the get-go, even before the federal Constitution. And another thing I want to make note of to counter the revisionist history of the fact of the lie that our founders were all racist and all these revisionist ideas, this Northwest Ordinance, 2 years before the Constitution, outlawed indentured servanthood and slavery in the Northwest mm-hmm. Territory.
Yep, sure did.
So I just wanted to make that point too. And that's part of our job, which is a task that we have, is we need to understand our history and not buy the lie that's being brought forward through media and through these different sources that are reshaping the men who were men of weight and wisdom that drafted principles of government intended to limit government in relationship to the private sphere and individuals, insofar as their actions and their what they do is not infringing on the equal rights of others. Mm-hmm. So there's that element I think we need to take into consideration. So through history, our public land laws were based on disposal of federally held land in trust to private appropriation. And then with the one thing I don't agree with in the Federal Land Policy Management Act is that changed to from disposal to retention.
Mm-hmm.
But let me make this point. There's a difference between retaining federal land that's already held in the federal hands and expanding federal right. land. And that's what we're facing now, is it's not just that 76, oh, we're going to retain all the federal land now and manage it. Now we have all these initiatives and congressional appropriations of dollars and different things that are being funneled into land acquisition, whether it's the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And that ties into our current situation with the present administration with the 30 by 30 agenda. And I want to make a point here for people that are aware of this executive action to tie up 30% of land and water in the U.S. I want to make the point here that process is already in process.
Mm-hmm.
this administration putting that in an executive action does not create that process. It is happening, has been happening. What this executive order will do is appropriate a large, it's specifically, they want to support local and state, private and tribally led nature conservation restoration efforts that are underway across America. So they're going to be pushing a ton of dollars into all these organizations that are already in the process of tying up development rights and help speed up that process. Mm-hmm. That's what this executive action is all about.
Well, that's a good lead in because Dick talked about how there's no common sense when they start talking about how things work from an economic standpoint. The same people who are expropriating tax dollars, American people are paying tax dollars into a process that's taking away the very land that allows us to make a living so that we can pay those tax dollars. I mean, this is like a downward spiral that has no end to it, right, Dick?
Well, I think so. And one of the things that is forgotten about those trusts or lands held by the federal government, they were held in trust until such a time as each state could take over management of the remainder lands not given to private property.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so that they're ignoring that responsibility. More states are able to take over and manage those lands on their own, but it is not of interest right now. In fact, people object to it, which is really interesting to me. Then the other thing that I think is going on is we have to look at the storyline of how NGOs infiltrate the executive branch of our government. The first thing philosophically that's entered into our thinking is the idea that if the environment isn't healthy, then humankind can't survive. If environment isn't returned back to its natural operational state, we will have a decline and a collapse of our ability to live. So that instituted the idea that a crisis can be a means to erode the property rights and the rights of our government, which we are seeing today. Climate change, well, that is going to be, it's going to be necessary to do away with property rights and preserve a large amount of land in doing so in order to solve climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the same thing with COVID. Our freedoms are to be restricted in order to make everybody safe. So there goes your property rights, the ability to work, have your business, So on. Mm-hmm. And the same was true with listing of salmon, where we have a crisis. And so the first discussion we had in that whole debate when that hit the fan was, can the Endangered Species Act trump water rights? And what we found out is the power behind the Endangered Species Acts did indeed trump water rights in the Meadow.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is what is being done. And then you have the NGOs coming in and trying to portray this picture to agency personnel and say, well, if this is able to be done, we're going to get this benefit, we're going to get a better environment, and we can, by all means, reinforce the precautionary principle that we have to do these things. The environment has to take priority because of the greater risk. Well, all of those arguments have nothing to do with constitutional government and the foundation, but those are the arguments that are being used to erode our constitutional government and property rights and our rights, because we're serving a bigger monster called environmental collapse.
Excuse me, just a second, Thumper. I want to mention the fact that you mentioned Hegel earlier, Dick, and obviously the whole environmental movement and the whole takeover of government through non-governmental organizations, this whole thing is classical Hegelian dialectic. Problem, action, reaction, solution. It is classical Hegelian dialectic, and it's at the core of how communism takes over private property. Okay, I'm sorry, Thumper. Go ahead.
Well, what I was going to bring up is, Dick and probably Nathan are both aware, there is a certain person who is a Washington State resident, owns a big, big, huge computer software company, or has been very integral in that. And he is buying up massive, massive tracts of land. Quite a bit here in the state of Washington, Montana, Nevada, all over the country. He's purchasing all these lands, and just recently, Nevada, passed. I forget what it was. I covered it on one of my shows, but basically allowing him, he's going to build one of these, you know, big, huge cities, you know, all self-sustaining, high tech. The whole works, and all of this. Do you think he's gonna run into the same EPA brick wall that you or I might run into when he starts trying to develop these lands that you know he's purchased?
Dick, you might want to take that one, but I know the answer.
well, I mean, really, you know?
I'll give you an example of where this is already happening. I believe it's in New Mexico. It's in a town in central New Mexico where they have a lot of rare earths. And the idea here is that we need to mine those rare earths in order to electrify our transportation system and get away from fossil fuels. Well, what has happened is the environmental groups there have stepped up and they're objecting to the whole thing because of what will happen to various ranching properties and other aspects of the environment that will occur with the mining. Rare earth mining is notoriously hard on the environment because you're going after rare minerals that take a lot of material to sift through to get to them. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a lot of territory that's going to be turned over after these materials. So the route availability of our new electrified future is actually being attacked. We're happy to get them from China or Chile, but not in the United States. Mm-hmm. So that's a very interesting point that I see happening. He may, for those reasons, end up in some form of controversy.
Well, you and Dick, I you're bringing up a really interesting point, because what happens is we give a free pass. Of course, this is Agenda 21, Agenda 2030. This is the UN in general right now. They're giving a free pass to all the communist and socialist countries to pollute as much as they want, to do whatever they want to the environment. The only ones they're attacking and trying to severely restrict and redistribute the wealth are the capitalist countries, the free countries. We're the target of all these programs. And yet the people are doing more damage to the environment than anyone else. They aren't even on the radar.
Yeah, that's quite right. We can do it better in the United States.
Yeah. Much better.
Yeah. Penalized for not being able to do that.
Well, Nathan, I love to hear your opinion on so many things. I come back on this one because, you know, we're talking classic Hegelian dialectic stuff here. You've watched it happen in Montana. You mentioned some of these things that are going on right now. But these NGOs and these groups who have been involved in So many of the purchases, one of the things, and I'll mention this and then I want your comments on it. One of the things that they do is the NGOs, because they don't have to go through the same scoping process and all the other things that government groups have to go through. So the governments use them. They pimp the NGOs to go out and buy these conservation easements and buy this land. And then they turn right around and sell it to either the federal government or to the state government. And they end up giving them a premium for the land. So they actually make money on this whole process. Now, I know this for a fact because I've seen it myself with the Forest Stewardship Foundation. I've watched them do it. Nathan, you have too. Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, there's it gets complex in some ways, but it gets back to what I was saying about the exemption provided for these organizations and how much of a cost actually flows through the public treasury in these processes, especially in relationship to land acquisition and perpetual conservation easements. So, for instance, in Montana, there's been several, but the one I'm most familiar with is there under the Montana Sage Grouse Conservation Program. There was an application of a ranch outfit that was assisted by the Nature Conservancy to put perpetual easements on these on about 6,000 acres, I think, of beaded property for the purpose of enhancing sage grouse habitat. So in other words, the way they enhance sage grouse habitat is prohibiting anybody from being able to do any development on the land. So in this particular case, the Nature Conservancy pulled 12,000 out of their own pocket initially, but the Montana with the legislation with the Montana Sage Grouse Conservation Program has a $10 million slush fund for these conservation preservation payments. Not all of them are perpetual easements. There's different things that money can flow into, but the big push under Bullock's administration was get as much perpetual easements basically in as you can. So these were still unfolding. So $12,000 came out of the TNC, $500,000 came out of the Montana fund, and another $1.5 million from the NRCS. That's roughly $2 million out of our public treasury that subsidized the purchase of this conservation easement, with the Nature Conservancy at the end of the day being the holder of that easement. Mm-hmm. The Montana does still have third party, some level of third party oversight, or the legislature does. But yeah, the Nature Conservancy in that case, I mean, another example is where they've been at work much longer is in northwestern Montana and the Plum Creek Timber Company area, and what's been going on up there with purchases. I think I have it right here. The Nature Conservancy Montana, their landmarks for 2020. There's a subsection of that article that says a bold vision for Montana forests. And they say TNC took a bold leap of faith when we began buying land from Plum Creek Timber Company more than two decades ago. On through the Montana legacy. So here's the programs that they do it through. The one I just mentioned was through the Montana Sage Grouse Conservation Program, but now with up in northwestern Montana, they're using the Montana Legacy and the Clearwater Blackfoot projects. And through that process, the Nature Conservancy ended up taking ownership of more than 500,000 acres. Mm-hmm. And then they say, quote, from this paper, but we never planned to hold in onto it forever. Our vision was always to see this land conserved for public use, for recreation and wildlife habitat, and to provide economic benefits to local communities. So the tour side of things, they always play the access card. So then they say in the two paragraphs later, over the years, TNC has moved the lion's share of land to the public domain. So that's been happening northwest Montana for some time. They still hold about 125,000 acres of the old Plum Creek Forest. So that tells me they've sold well over 300,000 acres to the Forest Service and BLM, yet again, at the taxpayer's expense. Mm-hmm. It's not going into development. And they always say access, too, just like the APR. They come out here and these NGOs, we want to help you guys have better access to your public lands. But these same groups have done nothing about the 21,950 miles of access roads that have been closed down, dozed in, fenced off in Western Montana and our Forest Services.
Absolutely.
The same organizations that come out to Eastern Montana and want to guarantee our quote unquote access, which most of which is already accessible, have done nothing about the real access issues in the state of Montana. And a lot of those groups were behind those initiatives that resulted in the closure of those roads, the tying up the, and the same thing with what Dick was saying, wood products industry in Montana's been destroyed too. 20 years ago, 33% of the cash income in the state was wood products. Mm-hmm. Now we're at, I think, under 10%. I don't have the
numbers under, right
in front of me. So back to the conservation easement deal and how these organizations make money through it. So what happens, a lot of times when these organizations approach a property, the value of the property is inflated based on the development potential of the property. And then they come in and slap perpetual easements on it that tie up the development rights. Then they reassess the property. Mm-hmm. So what happens? You have a significant reduction of the appraised value of the property. What happens to the local county governments in that case, that especially the governments that rely on property taxes as their main tax base? That reassessed value deteriorates from the overall tax base of the county, and your neighboring properties who didn't sign up for the easement have to make up that deficit. So yet again, costing more to the taxpayer in these processes. And of course, on small acreages, 6,000 acres, there may not be huge impacts, but you start looking at the core areas for sage-grouse habitat in Montana. They're large areas. There's already $10 million flowing into this. That's a fund right there available for them. I'm sure a lot of this COVID, $2 billion that's coming into Montana for COVID, even though we have a Republican-controlled legislature, there may be a substantial amount of funds that flow into that. And my fear is the American Prairies Reserve, who's buying up properties in the central Montana around the CMR Game Preserve region, maybe sooner than later, we'll be applying for these sage-grouse conservation funds, and the taxpayer will be subsidizing American Prairie Reserve acquisitions of lands across central Montana to phase it out of agriculture production. And the legislature is not intentionally doing that. But when you create this big slush fund for conservation initiatives for landowners to use and to apply for on their own lands, what makes you think the APR and these other NGOs that are starting to become landowners in the region will not tap into those funds? And all these ranchers and farmers that have been standing against this will not be very happy if they find out dollars from their pocketbook are subsidizing state tax money to subsidize APR acquisitions of those lands. And they would love the opportunity to pull money from the treasury to, because that's their aim. That's their philosophy. Mm-hmm. Tie up the land. And if you have a state program and a bunch of money available to do that, they will probably tap into that. So there's a lot of complex issues, a lot of money's flowing, a lot of different things. And that's where the money's the carrot on the stick. And that's where I think a lot of otherwise conservative people sadly are willing to go along with socialist measures as long as they agree with whatever end that may be there. So our task, I guess, is to try to expose to what the best of our ability some of these issues on how one thing I'll say, Okanagan County back in 2011 published a report called The Unsustainable Costs and Impacts of Government Land Acquisition. Mm-hmm. So this is 10 years ago. And that report highlighted how much money from our public treasury is being appropriated into tying up development rights and private property. And in this case, it was specific to the Methow Valley in Washington State, but that same principle applies across the West. And since that report, they haven't slowed down, and this administration is putting it in high speed.
Well, and Nathan, we did a program last week on COGS, that's Councils of Government. What you're talking about is reducing the tax base in the county because all this private inholding is being taken out of private, and it's either through tax exemption going to NGOs and things like that, or, as you say, it's being reduced in value to the point where the tax base is much smaller. Bottom line is, all these things affect local government. Well, you get into an area like Mineral County, that has a very, very small population anyway, and has very limited amount of funds to do programs with, eventually you won't have the money in Mineral County to do the necessary public functions. Well, what happens then? What happens then is we have to go to councils of government. We have to go to bigger regional governments, and we get rid of our local elected officials. You connect the dots. That's what we're doing today with this program. You connect the dots, and it's all about getting rid of private property and getting rid of elected officials at a local level. Dick, come in on that conversation.
Well, yeah, this is really an interesting area because one of the things I'll mention is particularly when you have a state agency buying private land, we have a process here, what is called PILT payments.
Oh, yeah.
It's mm-hmm. a payment of...
in lieu of taxes. Yep.
Taxes, right? Mm-hmm. Well, our county is barely getting 50% of those payments. So the idea of, well, we'll buy this, keep it in the public preservation for salmon and the rest of the environment, and we'll pay the taxes for you. But what we found out in doing that report that Nate pointed out in 2011 is that ownership of that property actually produces more business revenue because that person is creating a wealth creating product, selling and ranch through ranching or farming. He has to buy tools, other things in the community to make his operation function. And that may support seven other businesses in doing that. Mm-hmm. And so your B&O tax goes down for your state and county governments when that happens. So it's not just a matter of, well, you just get your taxes paid for by the state in lieu of the private person paying them. No, it doesn't work. You're losing a whole environmental economic sector in the process. The other thing that has gone on is that with this idea that, well, we're going to come in, a state or an NGO, and buy your land and buy up the and pay the price of that land as though you had the development rights and could benefit from them. What that is doing is artificially elevating the price of real estate in that area. So what happens then, say a farmer understands another farmer is going to sell out and he wants that farmer's property. Well, the Fish and Wildlife wants that property for preserving the environment that it has. You can't compete as a farmer to buy that property with Fish and Wildlife because farming land to be productive in Okanagan County has to be around $1,500 an acre or less, not five times that, which the Fish mm-hmm. and Wildlife Service will pay, including the development rights. So what you're actually doing is you're curtailing the ability of farms to survive economically if they need more land to make more product to stay in business. So all of that kind of works together. This is not a positive thing at all.
Yeah, no, it's connecting the dots between all of these different programs, and you guys are doing a great job of doing that right now. One of the things that comes out with all of this land acquisition is that ultimately, even though private organizations are coming in and buying the land, like I said earlier, they're really pimping for the federal agencies, because if you get a federal agency or even a state agency, they have to follow a very rigid protocol on how they purchase property. They have to go through and do the environmental attributes. They have to do the economics. They have to do all these things that are part of a very rigid protocol. And when the environmental groups go in, they can do it basically at whatever structure they want. And then if they choose to turn that land over to the federal or the state agencies, it's a piece of cake. You know, it's a very simple process.
Well, doesn't the government have to do eminent domain to get private?
Exactly. Property? Eminent domain. And then they have to do all the studies that go with it. Yeah. Right.
So the NGOs buy it as a private property transaction and essentially donate it to the government.
Yeah. Only they don't donate it. They usually end up making a pretty good profit on it.
Yeah, that's true. But then the government becomes a willing buyer to a willing seller. Mm-hmm.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. That's how they bypass the process of condemning an eminent domain to an unwilling seller. They do it through these other groups, and they do it very, very sneaky, very clandestinely.
That's right.
Yeah. Nathan, I know you've got opinions on this too.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking, you know, I with background in theology, I always a lot of times make biblical applications as well. And there's really nothing new under the sun. When King Ahab, and I think it's 1 Kings, might be 2 Kings, when he came to Naboth and said, I want your vineyard and I'll pay you the value of it, or I'll give you another vineyard that has a higher value. And Naboth's answer was, how dare I sell the inheritance of my fathers? And that was based on the biblical concept of not removing your landmark and the concepts of inheritance. And that's another thing that's important. We don't have time to get into today, but private property also constitutes inheritance, which is very important to God and very important to life and freedom and happiness. So with King Ahab, he came to Naboth, wanted the vineyard, coveted the vineyard. And Naboth said no. Ahab went home sad, skipped dinner, went to bed, and his wife was Jezebel. And she went in and said, why are you so downcast, king? And we'll stop right there really quick. The principle already we see there is that Ahab acknowledged he couldn't arbitrarily take Naboth's vineyard. The reason he went home and was sad and skipped dinner is because he recognized the sovereign jurisdiction of Naboth over his own property. And what did he say when he wanted to buy it? Not for sale. So Jezebel goes in and says, why are you so downcast, O king? And let's just look at Ahab as Ahab's government. He's the king. Jezebel is his wife. Let's say she's the special interest here.
Mm-hmm.
You're the king, Ahab. Why don't you just go take it, kind of thing. But she didn't say that. She said, basically, rest easy. I'll get that vineyard for you. So what was the method she used to acquire Naboth's vineyard? She got documents together. She committed fraud by forging the king's signet on those documents. And she held a party where all the nobles in the land came together and held Naboth on high. Very similar to what's happening in the eastern Montana with the TNC and some of these special interest groups that are coming in. You know, the APRs over here, well, we're not like them. You know, you ranchers, you're good. You're really doing a good job and we want to help you. You know, they play that card. And that's the same tactic Jezebel used clear back then when they had a goal to acquire property. And she held a party for Naboth, put him on high, and then brought in false accusers, which resulted, long story short, they stoned Naboth to death. And at the end of the day, Ahab had Naboth's vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
And the prophet Elijah came and rebuked him for taking. God still held Ahab, even though Jezebel do it, even though the special interest did it for Ahab, God still held Ahab accountable and government and those officials accountable. And in that case, Elijah looked at Ahab and said, the dogs are going to lick up your blood in the same spot they licked up the blood of Naboth. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a biblical example of this, of these special interest ways in which property, and there's principles you can weed out from there. Like I said, the first thing we need to recognize there is Naboth recognized his limited authority. He couldn't arbitrarily take the vineyard from Naboth. So they resorted to other legal means to acquire that property. And there's tons of other examples like that. And But just for a biblical application, I think, like I said, there's nothing new under the sun. And the thing about deception is that it's so deceiving. So we need, it wouldn't be deception otherwise. So we need to learn to see through some of the surface veneer of a lot of these organizations, and do our due diligence, do our homework, and stand on the truth in that regard. One thing I will say on top of that, a lot of local land use policies in Montana are pretty strong, and a lot of other states as well. The resource plans that have strong relation that protects private property rights. This is from multiple counties in Montana that have similar language in relationship to this. One, counties suffer no net loss of tax revenue, that all private property interests are protected and enhanced, that citizens of the county will suffer no adverse economic impacts, that all government entities investigate and attempt to increase local economic development by increasing the amount of privately controlled land within the county, that federal and state land agencies should not acquire any private lands or rights in private lands without first ensuring compliance with these items listed above. So we do have the law on our side at a county level and on a lot of levels. There's a lot of what you could call bad law out there, but our task is to reinforce those principles at the local level to protect Naboth and his vineyard.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's well said. Talk a little bit, you and Dick both chime in on this, but talk about how you're trying to enlist local government, trying to get county commissioners all over the area to get involved in this process and to protect the private property, because they have a vested interest in this. If they lose their tax base, they don't have the ability to provide government in a reasonable way. And so local governments have a vested interest. Talk about how you're enlisting them to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem.
Well, the key thing that I'm working on right now is our county is in the process of writing the comprehensive plan for the county. So the comprehensive plan is actually the tool, if it's written well, that the county has to protect itself from state and federal intrusion on the custom, culture, and economic viability and welfare of that county. But if you do not have a good coordination section in your comprehensive plan that spells that out and cites the relationship between state and federal obligations whenever they want to come in and do something in that county, they have to coordinate with the county and make sure that there is no conflict with the county comprehensive plan or land development goals. And that's one thing that our county has not stood up to, and we're working on trying to get that done. If that's not there, your county doesn't have the standing to really push back. All the decisions on a county level hinge around what your commissioners are able to do and whether or not they fully exercise the power of their office. If you can't get them to do that, then your county is lost, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dick, when you do that comprehensive plan, be incredibly afraid of Agenda 21, 2030 language being incorporated into that comprehensive plan, because that has been a problem all over the country. And do you know Tom DeWeese, American Policy Center?
I know a little bit about him, yeah.
Okay. I would highly recommend, and I've got his contact information, I would highly recommend anybody who is putting together a comprehensive plan for their county, consult with him. They've got a model comprehensive plan that they've done that keeps the Agenda 21 language out of it, because what happens, a lot of people don't understand, you know, how words matter. And words really do matter. And if they incorporate all these sustainability regulations and sustainability into the program, it feeds right into UN Agenda 21.
Yes, it really does. But I would like to have that contact information. If you can go ahead and email me.
I will do it. I will do it. Absolutely essential. Nathan, you've been working with Ross Butcher and some of the county commissioners in Montana who are trying to stand up and fight back against this, these NGOs and these groups coming in and using all their influence and money to basically take away private property. Talk a little bit about that relationship, if you can. I know there's probably some things you can't talk about, but, you know, how important it is that you get county commissioners on board with this whole thing and get them involved.
Yeah, Dan, the way I started is as soon as I found out with already having a constitutional basis in my background, as soon as I found out and grasped and understood the coordination process and how local governments can be involved in these decision making and hold accountability to our federal counterparts, going to several county commissions in the surrounding region, and just getting on calling in advance and, hey, can I come in and visit? And in this case, it started with me it was mainly on the APR topic, but it was just going in and candidly talking with the commissioners. And my first question to some of them was, has anybody from the Bureau of Land Management been in here and described to you the National Environmental Policy Act process and the regulations and your role in that? And the answer was no. And there was a lot of, when I started on this, what I found right off the bat is there was a lot of frustration in county officials who had sat through these processes, who gave some level of comment in the process. And then at the end of the day, the documents were published, they were listed as contributing authors, and they did not incorporate their input. So for those of you out there that may be listening that want to try to encourage your elected officials, or maybe you are an elected official at a county level, a lot of people have been discouraged in these processes. So it started with me of just sitting down and trying to explain, walk through that with those county commissioners, explain what they can do, analyzing their local land use policies and plans, because it's just like our Constitution. James Madison said the Constitution's nothing but parchment. The only thing that gives it power is a thorough knowledge of the people. Same thing with a county resource plan. You can have the best resource plan in the world. If you don't know it, if you don't apply it in the process, it's just a piece of paper on a shelf somewhere or a digital file on your computer. You have to apply it in the process. And with that said, I do want to make a distinction, because that's where another confusion comes in with local governments, is the coordination process as a whole, or cooperation is another term. And they're both terms in federal law. There's cooperation, coordination, and consistency. And I just want to, for those of you that may work in these areas and may be listening, I just want to distinguish between cooperation and coordination. Cooperation under the National Environmental Policy Act, all federal agencies must complete a NEPA analysis for proposed actions that are likely to have an impact on the natural or human environment. Federal agencies can designate state or local governments to become formal partners in the NEPA process as cooperating agencies. So cooperation is an actual formal process where county commissions are physically coming to the table, engaging throughout the process and assisting the agency in developing those plans. Coordination is when creating land use plans or resource management plans, BLM and U.S. Forest Service are required to coordinate their plans with state and local government plans. Coordination is a separate process from cooperation and must occur regardless of whether state or local governments were designated as cooperating agencies. Agencies must make efforts to draft federal plans that coordinate with state and local plans. So the distinction is there. Let's say you have one county, let's just say Garfield, that is designated by a federal agency as a cooperating agency, and you have another county, let's say Daniels, that is not a cooperating agency in the process, but yet has potential effect within their jurisdiction. If they have a substantive resource management plan, whether or not they're a cooperating agency or not, the agencies are bound by law to coordinate their decision-making and their planning documents with existing local government plans. And if you're, and another thing local governments commissioners need to do is make these plans. If you have good resource plans, go give a visit to your local BLM office or your Forest Service office and make that plan available to them. Because if you wait until they get through the whole process and they take all your land and they say, when you bring it to their table and they didn't know about your plan or your resource policy, and you take it to them last second and say, hey, you didn't coordinate with this, that's your fault.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be there taking the initiative and bringing those things forward. So I don't know if that's, you know, answers what you were kind of asking me, Dan, but there is some complexities to this, but it's simpler if you, that's why I kind of focused in this conversation about fundamental principles and constitutional principles. Because if you get that, that helps you weed through some of the coordination issues with federal agencies. So,
well, you know, that's exactly what I told you too. We'd run out of time, that this would go a lot faster than you realize. But I was trying to get you to talk about that, because the difference between cooperation or consultation, which is the other term they use, and coordination is that cooperation and consultation, you're playing on the federal government's playing field. If you get the coordination process by creating your own resource plan in your county, then they have to play on your field. And it's a huge difference there. It's like the difference between day and night. Cooperation and consultation, basically the government comes in and they say, here's our plan, what do you think? And you're going to play the game. You're going to say, well, we'd like to tweak this little thing or tweak that little thing. It's for lazy county commissioners that don't understand their responsibility to protect private property. The guys that understand the idea of protecting private property, those are counties that are going to want to coordinate. And that means they've got to have a natural resource plan in place. Dick, we're almost out of time. I want to give you a shot at this.
Yeah, I think that's very important on the land use language and a plan, because one of the things that's important about that is the normal citizen, if they understand that plan, can also put their commissioners to the feet to the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really helpful to the citizen who wants to have their government work well to be able to call them to account. So without that, the comprehensive plan can be ignored.
Mm-hmm.
It really can.
Yeah, absolutely. And you both said something very, very key here. County commissioners, for the most part, they're the most important elected official that we have in this country, because if we follow our constitution, we've got a bottom-up government, not a top-down government. We need to hold their feet to the fire so that they are understanding the importance of their role, and it isn't to go to lunch and suck up to the Forest Service or the BLM. Their role is to protect the citizens who elect them, period.
Exactly. And they have the power to actually say no, no way on any of these government or NGO intrusions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They have the power. They need to realize how much power they really have. I know, Nathan, you've luckily you're working with Ross Butcher. And I think I know Ed Butcher's a good friend of mine. And I can tell you that the Butchers have a good understanding of the role of government. Ross is working pretty hard with you guys to try to help with your program out there in eastern Montana, aren't they? Oh, you must be muted.
Yeah, there's been okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, several counties have really come. I think there was 14 or 15 counties that came on board with our RMP comments. Quite a few counties were on board with the other projects we engaged on. So yeah, we've had relatively good support on a countywide basis. And if you do excellent work and professional work product, and you go in and you offer to help your commissioners, you don't go in and shame them. You go in and say, hey, here's a foundation, and I want to help you stand on that and use your constitutional authority to follow through on these issues. So we need to come alongside them, hold them accountable to their oath of office, and move forward in that way. And one more final thing I'll say is that county governments are the only geopolitical within their boundaries. They're the only body that has jurisdiction on all lands within that county boundary. Federal and state only has jurisdiction on certain site specific locations. So that's another important area to understand.
No, you guys done a wonderful job. I'm sorry, we are out of time, but I have to tell you, Nathan, I told you earlier, it'll go faster than you think, and we'll have to have you guys back on. Let's further this discussion. Maybe we can get Jim Carlson. Maybe we can get Norm McLeod on, and we can have a real good talk about how people like yourselves can make the difference in whether or not we protect private property at a local level. You guys are doing great. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Nathan. I appreciate your participation in this, and I look forward to seeing you guys again in a very short time.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I appreciate it, Dan.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen.
And I'd like to thank you for Patriot Soapbox. Appreciate Nathan and Dick, both of you. Don't be strangers.
All right. Thank you.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you. Well,
this is a fascinating subject because so many people don't realize what an integral part private property is into our whole system of government. And it's interesting, but a lot of people confuse natural law or unalienable rights and our Christian background that was part of the writing of the Constitution. They confuse that and what private property really is, because they think that government can control the people, and it's not really. Government is supposed to be instituted to protect property, to protect the citizens. It's not to provide anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like the constitutional fellow, what was his first name?
Yeah, Michael Badnarik.
Michael. Yeah, you know, it really boils down to property.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the preservation and the honoring of your personal property, whether it be the things you acquire with currency or the actual currency itself, and your time is your property, and what you receive in benefit for your time invested, is your property. And, we see in so many different ways it being attacked and literally in some cases ripped from your hands at the point of a gun almost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, people need to understand that private property, the best example of private property is your own body and your own mind. If you are not allowed to have freedom of thought, you'll never have freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. If you can't, as long as your thoughts don't harm others, you ought to be able to have freedom to think anything you want. And certainly that's right now, that's in serious jeopardy in this country. You know, the free speech zones on the university campuses, that's just complete nonsense. You know, the fact that they would do that, tells us that universities don't support freedom of speech. They don't even support freedom of thought anymore. They want their little Marxist socialist paradigm, and anybody that thinks outside of the box, they're going to try to shut them up.
Well, I mean, freedom of speech in a box is what they gave us. You know, is what they're mm-hmm. what they're allowing there.
If Tomorrow all the things were gone. I'd worked for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, where the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.